Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We hope all the moms out there had a wonderful Mother's Day weekend. Today, we give you your next gift, a belated gift. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives. And, Jim, we start with a tentative good, because there's been a lot of concern that if Donald Trump doesn't start polling better against Hillary Clinton, that there's going to be carnage down ballot. Well, over at 538, the site that Nate Silver, of course, has made famous, they've done a little analysis. Seth Maskett wrote this piece, and it says that right now it doesn't look like there's going to be as much bloodshed as we thought, but obviously it's still early. He says, are we witnessing the culmination of decades of rising anger among the masses against out-of-touch elites driven by the party's own campaign strategies, or does this crisis go away if Trump is not elected? To have a little bit of analysis at this point, he says they looked at open seat Senate and gubernatorial primaries in competitive state. And he says, what I found was a substantial number of experienced mainstream Republicans leading in their races for major office, which does not suggest a party that is cracking up. He looked on the Senate side at Florida, where there's a lot of people running for the seat currently held by Marco Rubio, with the top two being conservative Congressman Ron DeSantis and more moderate Congressman David Jolly, as well as the lieutenant governor there. In Nevada, he says pretty much a two-person race, but Joe Heck is outpolling Sharon Angle at this point. Given what happened 6 years ago, that's probably for the better. In Indiana, we just saw a primary where Todd Young easily beat Marlon Stutzman. Some conservatives I know aren't happy with that result, certainly. They also looked at the governor's races in New Hampshire, Missouri, and on and on. So, Jim, we're just looking at primaries right now where incumbents usually don't see that stiff of a challenge, and we'll see what it looks like when they actually go up against a Democrat. But right now, it doesn't look like the Pitchfork Brigade is planning to root everybody out throughout the ballot.
One of the things that kind of jumps out about this is that, yes, on the one hand, Trump could argue that he is a leader of a massive national movement, huge, that definitely has turned over the table when it comes to the Republican presidential primary. But for those of us who look at this and say, wait a minute, is this really based on his stances? The demand for a border wall, deportation of illegal immigrants, wariness of trade, and to the extent you can figure out what Trump's positions are, because they tend to change frequently, are there other candidates running for House, running for Senate, that are ready to kind of say, yes, we want to help enact the Trump agenda? There really isn't much example of that. There's one guy who's challenging Paul Ryan, who's kind of emulating the Trump style and tone. But the idea of what I think we're going to have a very big dispute about whether the Trump phenomenon was driven by policy and ideas and things people wanted government to do, or whether it was driven by personality. You might think that if there was this era of massive anger at the Republican Party in Congress, in the sense that they're all sellouts and they haven't done anything and they've given Obama everything he wants, which is total nonsense, just read my colleague Charlie Cook on this, that you'd see tons of people running for office. And as they point out in this piece, there are fewer Republicans running than there were in 2012, fewer Republicans running than there were in 2010, the height of the Tea Party era. So I don't think that this is if this is a pyramid of a movement, you have Trump at the top, you got the people, the grassroots, but really very little in between. And you don't see, other than a couple exceptions, too many senators, too many members of the House saying, yeah, I'm endorsing Trump. His policies are my policies. His agenda is my agenda. Let's all march forward. I think there's something kind of missing there. So I have this feeling, look, if this really was a broad-based movement, I think it says something about the Trump supporters that they're so president-focused and have at this point not really indicated much interest in never mind electing their own House and Senate candidates or gubernatorial nominees. They're just not paying attention to that. They are a demographic that has this strange contradiction at its heart. They're really furious about government, but they have really very little interest in learning more about how it works and how to fix it.
Well, Trump hasn't really mentioned down-ballot races yet, and he probably won't at this point if he hasn't done it already. Maybe he's paying about as much attention to that as he did the delegate selection process. But
true. Yeah, look, with people he's got a tweet at, you know. By the way, Greg, I just want to point out, when we began this podcast, you didn't even congratulate me. and that's just sad. Well, that's a fine how do you do, you know. Those who don't understand, I'm quoting Trump and the way he began his CNN interview today, because I just think for the rest of the week, everyone should say, hey, you haven't even congratulated me yet. How dare you? So
All right, on to the bad martini now. This probably doesn't come as a huge shock, but it's good to know about. This is from Gizmodo, which, if you haven't heard of, Giz's brother is Quasi, big Notre Dame fan. Facebook workers routinely suppressed news stories of interest to conservative readers from the social network's influential trending news section, according to a former journalist who worked on the project. This individual says that workers prevented stories about the right-wing CPAC gathering, Mitt Romney, Rand Paul, and other conservative topics from appearing in the highly influential section, even though they were organically trending among the site's users. Several former Facebook news curators, as they were known internally, also told Gizmodo that they were instructed to artificially inject selected stories into the trending news module, even if they weren't popular enough to warrant inclusion, but because they were important, or in some cases weren't trending at all. Among the deep-sixed or suppressed topics on the list, former IRS official Lois Lerner, who was accused by Republicans of inappropriately scrutinizing conservative groups, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, popular conservative news aggregator The Drudge Report, Chris Kyle, the former Navy SEAL who was murdered in 2013, and former Fox News contributor Steven Crowder. So, Jim, we know from Mark Zuckerberg's political activism that he's all about the liberal causes, but stifling the natural interest of the users might come as a surprise to many. But once again, the left is trying to not only limit what we see, but tell us what to think about.
On the one hand, this completely affirms all of your worst suspicions of how big tech companies like this operate. If something isn't to their liking, they don't want you to see it. And there are other things that they think are important, you should. Now, the interesting thing is in this article, they give two examples of the Facebook curating team kind of pushing two stories onto the audience. And you kind of almost sympathize with them because it says at one point, curators would inject a story even if it wasn't being widely discussed. Quote, people stopped caring about Syria, one former curator said. And if it wasn't trending on Facebook, it would make Facebook look bad. Now, I can almost sympathize with that, right? I mean, people get tired of hearing about this terrible bloody war off in a far-off land. They don't think it affects them. They're much more interested in, say, the Kardashians or something. And so they stop paying attention. And this is Facebook's way of saying, hey, no, you should pay attention to this. This matters. This is important. We can argue about kind of the morality, the ethics of that. But part of the purpose of the news industry is to say, hey, here are things going on that you might not think are important, but here's why they are. The flip side of that is that the same curator said the Black Lives Matter movement was also injected into the Facebook's trending news module. Facebook got a lot of pressure about not having a trending topic for Black Lives Matter, the individual said. They realized it was a problem, and they boosted it in the ordering. They gave it preference over other topics. When we injected it, everyone started saying, yeah, now I'm seeing it as number one. To quote Eric Erickson's argument, you will be made to care, right? Whether if Black Lives Matter strikes you as a fringe movement, doesn't matter. We got to mainstream it. We got to tell people that this is a big deal, even if it doesn't seem like that big a deal. People will argue about that. But basically the idea that this our suspicions that this was nothing of the sort when they claimed it was organic and what people were, sharing and trending and people were most interested in. All of our suspicions are confirmed. It's really been a booming couple of years for paranoia, Greg.
Yes. Speaking of suspicions confirmed, let's move right along to the crazy martini because the media, and I'm not sure Facebook belongs in the media category, but in terms of convincing readers and listeners and viewers about what's really going on, the sleight of hand is very deep here as well. You probably, if you've done much reading over the past few days, know about the New York Times Magazine profile this weekend of Ben Rhodes. He is the Deputy National Security Advisor who is very close to President Obama. And basically, he admitted the fact that given the unpopularity of the Iranian regime and the idea of striking a nuclear deal with Iran, the White House basically fed a bunch of bogus facts to the media and even cooked up a bunch of experts to parrot their talking points back to the press to convince them of this. Here's just a couple of quotes. Ben Rhodes saying, the average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. They literally know nothing. Unquote. Then when it comes to feeding them the quote-unquote experts, in the spring of last year, this is the Times story now, legions of arms control experts began popping up at think tanks and on social media and then became key sources for hundreds of often clueless reporters. We created an echo chamber, Rhodes admitted when I asked him to explain the onslaught of freshly minted experts cheerleading for the deal. They were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. And this whole story was written by David Samuels in the New York Times Magazine. So, Jim, this is something that you would probably see in the movies or on a TV show about completely duping the press. I don't know if we could say they were completely fooled, although he did say they were clueless. But another big part of it is that they're basically cheerleaders of this administration.
Yeah, this is a fascinating interview, just layer upon layer. For starters, I mean, they notice that this is the Obama administration taking a victory lap with 6 months left in office, right? You know, they're high-fiving, they're saying, this is how we did our great achievements. Secondly, they're increasingly open about the fact that they did so with exceptionally dishonest means. When you have a White House administration official say, you know, high-level guy saying, quote, we set up an echo chamber, unquote, he's not even trying to finesse it. Right, he's basically saying, you know, we said this was going to work out, and then we referred to experts who we had given all the information to, saying it was going to work out, as independent arbiters telling us this deal is going to work out. You know, it says a great deal about President Obama that he entrusted so much to Rhodes, because he's, you know, the kind of man who'd be arrogant enough to do something like this and then go out and crow about it. And then the next thing is that, like, the you know, they went out, they attacked the critics. They said the critics were being partisan. They said the critics were being foolish. That he's very proud of the fact that he basically said it was either accept this deal or war. There were no possible options in between. The other thing is that the clubbiness between the New York Times reporter and Rhodes himself, they act like old buddies, and it's just gushing about how he's like Holden Caulfield. By the way, Greg, did you like Holden Caulfield from The Catcher in the Rye? Right? I mean, like, he's kind of a whiny twerp, isn't he? Yes. Everybody's phony. I'm the only authentic one. I'm going to save the kid. Yeah. You know, just probably for most of us, he's one of the most insufferable whiners in the history of American literature. But fine, whatever. But this idea of I was discussing with somebody this weekend, and I said, wouldn't it be great to have a president who didn't come to office thinking they already know everything about how the world works? And they don't just charge ahead with their ideas regardless of what happens on their watch. And so this response was, well, good news, Jim. We're about to have a Republican nominee who doesn't know anything about how anything works. So he can learn a great deal on the job. That here Obama was completely convinced from day one. Remember on the Democratic primary 2008, he said, yes, I will meet with Iranian leaders without preconditions. They've always wanted to reach out to Iran. They always wanted to say to Iran, we trust you. And now, you know, now that you're the moderates we've always dreamed of, it's going to work out. And every little bit of counter evidence was ignored or downplayed or dismissed. Or if you're bringing it up, you are partisan or you're on the same side of the Iranian mullahs, as Obama said. You know, and this is a grand scam on the American people. And a guy, somebody like Rhodes should be hanging his head in shame about this. But he's kind of openly boasting and smug and insufferable about this. He's very proud of himself with this. And what's kind of fascinating, I think Eli Lake had a very good piece about this. He said, you know, Rhodes really wanted to have a serious debate about the foreign policy, but the country just wasn't ready for it.
Oh.
So they had to lie to us. We made them do this. We really should be putting people in stocks for having that kind of mentality towards the American people.
The poor, dumb American people just can't get how great we are. Wonderful. You know, I remember, Jim, when I was a senior in high school and I knew I wanted to be in journalism. I went to a bunch of different schools and they talked about how great their journalism schools were. And a lot of them were very good. And I went to Hillsdale where journalism was not even a major. And I was like, well, why don't you have a journalism school? And the lady across the desk from me said, we would like you to know something before you write about it. That's a really good point. And so I ended up majoring in history. And I'm guessing you, since you're so well-versed, you read well. I'm sure GW had some courses where you learned information as well as how to report. And I think we obviously need more of that because Rhodes is basically pointing out we skunked all these young kids in their 20s and early 30s who don't know any better than to just lap up whatever we give them.
Yeah, but you know what I'm going to observe here, Greg? And this is not to put a particularly forthright defense of GW's journalism program. Why would your instinct be that the Iranians could be trusted? If you look at any recent chapter of history, you can go back to the hostage crisis. You can go back to their complicity and role in bombing Khobar Towers back in the 1990s. You can look at their support of bombing the Jewish center in Argentina back. You know, like this is not a sudden turn of events for the Iranians. And it's not like, you know, the whole time during the Iran deal, you and I during this podcast, Fruitless Spotlight, here they are practicing a bombing run on a model U.S. Aircraft carrier. The tanker war back in the late 80s. I mean, if you know anything, and I guess the idea is that people who are covering the White House don't know any of this stuff. And if you don't know any of this stuff, this is not to hold up you and I as great geniuses, Greg. I think that's what Mrs. Corumbus and Mrs. Garrity would concur with. It's mostly that, like, we're just curious enough about how the world works that if you're going to know about Iran, why not study it, right? And the other thing is that these so-called experts, I mean, Fareed Zakaria, the plagiarist, who still has his television show on CNN, wrote right before the 2009 Iranian elections, everything you know about Iran is wrong, and how they weren't this brutal regime, and how they were cosmopolitan and sophisticated and rapidly changing and ready to be a responsible player in their region. And then they fixed the election results, and then there was an uprising, and then they beat the heck out of their protesters, poured boiling water on them, killed that protester, Nadav, and it turned out, Fareed Zakaria, that everything we knew about Iran turned out to be right. And everybody who insisted that the Iranian regime had moderated and become more sophisticated and wasn't as brutal as it used to be were proven completely wrong by that. And within a few years, Fareed Zakaria was back to making this exact same argument. And so I want to ask these people, who really is the reality-based community here? Who are the ones who are seeing things clearly? You know, guys like Rhodes and a lot of these media allies are absolutely insisting that we can reach peace with Iran. And if they have to ignore everything Iran does to do that, they will do it. And it's just kind of a, you know, the disturbing realization that people setting policy are living in a fantasy world. So happy Monday, everybody.
Oh, you say it so well. I think they just
go back to covering something cheery like the presidential election.
Careful what you wish for, Garrity.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But the American people got it right. Anyway, didn't matter. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.